Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, chemical weapons inspectors in Syria will visit the site of an alleged attack on Wednesday. President Trump's lawyer secretly represented conservative talk show host Sean Hannity. The latest on a simmering trade spat between China and the United States.
I can just stop buying U.S. goods and stop selling products from America.
Also ahead, two recent Western films on Russia depict the country's dark political underbelly. It's all on today's International Edition. Adult film actress Stormy Daniels was seated in the courtroom on Monday as a federal judge ordered President Donald Trump's longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to reveal the name of a client he had hoped to keep secret, Fox News personality Sean Hannity, an outspoken champion of the president. The revelation came during a hearing in which lawyers for Cohen and Trump sought to persuade a judge to allow them to review documents and records federal agents seized from Cohen's office, home, and hotel last week as part of an investigation of Cohen's business dealings and finances. Joining us now to understand all of this is criminal defense attorney Jonathan Mandel. What exactly was the purpose of Monday's hearing?
Judge Wood was attempting to determine who would be the best person to make the decision as to who's going to sort out that which is relevant to the inquiry as opposed to that which is irrelevant. I assume the issue they're looking for is his violation of probably election law and possibly other types of violations, but that seems to be the primary issue.
What came out of this hearing?
Well, apparently she put it over. She's asking the parties to decide. There were three different options. One would be the special master. The other was the taint team, which I believe is from the Department of Justice. That's internal. Special master is somebody who comes from the outside and looks through it and sorts it out. And then the final one was a proposal that Mr. Cohen and Mr. Trump do their own editing. That, I think, she took off the table pretty quickly.
What would that mean, that they would do their own editing?
In other words, they would determine what, if any, evidence was relevant to the Department of Justice inquiry. They'd make that decision on their own, which is a little like the proverbial hen house being guarded by the foxes.
Well, you mentioned election law violations. What other laws could have been broken, and why is that a potential issue?
The other laws could be attorney-client. His status with the bar is going to be a huge issue, the New York bar. I don't know whether they're going to be looking into coercion and threats. That's a whole other issue that came out of the allegations by Stormy McDaniels, is that she was threatened. I think they're going to look into pretty much everything he did. Another possible violation would be, did he record phone calls? Because it appears that he did make recordings of conversations, and that, at least in California, is illegal unless you have the permission of the party, or unless there are certain categories, like if you think there's going to be a crime, a certain type of crime like extortion, you can record it. But generally, the law in most states is you can't record a conversation without notifying the other party. So there's a potential for both coercion, there could be extortion, there could be threats.
Mm-hmm.
But the obvious one is the election law. Nobody quite knows what they're up to.
When you say election law, you mean because trying to silence someone before an election? Is that what you mean by paying them off?
Oh, no, I mean, that would be one reason. But the election law violation they're most looking at is whether it was declared. If, in fact, he cut these deals on behalf of Mr. Trump and those deals were somehow contributions. That's how I think this thing started, was the belief that at least when he was providing his services, remarkably for free, whether in fact he was providing a service to the campaign and therefore should have declared the monies that he paid should have been declared as election expense.
How would all this impact the president himself? Would this be damaging for him in some legal way?
He sustained a lot of damage legally. This may be the most damaging thing of all. If they can connect him to any of those potential violations, they could be quite damaging. But at this point, I don't know. It seems like mostly Michael Cohen seems to be doing things that are for the benefit of someone without them paying for it. It's almost like he's off the reservation doing things, and he's claiming that his client didn't know that he was doing it. And that's the part that's kind of crazy. If I may say, it's the most non-traditional attorney-client relationship I've ever heard. Because two things. One, his clients usually pay attorneys, and Cohen said he wasn't paid. And secondly, attorneys usually counsel clients. And Cohen said that he never talked to Trump about what he did for him. So this is the most untraditional attorney-client relationship I think I've ever heard of.
Well, how likely is it that, the president didn't know that Mr. Cohen paid these people for their silence before the election?
Well, I think that's not a legal issue. That's more an issue of human nature. It seems hard to believe that he wouldn't know, and it also seems incredibly difficult to believe that Cohen wouldn't have wanted the money back, that he was basically donating this to Trump. It's hard to believe a lot of things about Mr. Trump and Mr. Cohen, but there is no traditional lawyer-client relationship, and I don't think that, from what I've heard, I don't think Cohen was ever performing any legal functions with the three clients he had. He doesn't do the traditional legal functions. He is that what's called the fixer, and that's really not the typical lawyer.
So if that's the case, then would that sort of invalidate the argument that there's attorney-client privilege?
Absolutely. That's the issue. I don't know how can you have an attorney-client privilege where you never communicate. Attorney-client privilege is to protect a client, to give him confidentiality or her with an attorney. And if that attorney never actually communicates about what that attorney's doing to benefit the client, I guess there could be one. Whether or not they're paid doesn't make a difference. But if the client doesn't know what's up, then there is a question as to whether there's an attorney-client privilege if there's no attorney-client relationship. If, as I said, Cohen's running off the reservation on his own, then I don't think Trump would be tied to it, and I think Cohen would be doing it on his own.
Where do you think all of this will go?
Oh, I don't know. I do think that the level of professionalism and the fact they had an ongoing investigation of Cohen means it's pretty serious.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Criminal defense attorney Jonathan Mandel. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Kenya's electoral body in turmoil after three commissioners resign. Russian investigative journalist dies after a fall from a balcony. The U.S. and Britain issue a rare joint warning on Russian hackers. And love and murder in Rwanda. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog said Monday its team has not yet been able to visit the site of an alleged chemical attack on April 7th near Syria's capital. Russia's deputy foreign minister said the mission wasn't allowed because it lacked approval. That approval has since been granted and will happen on Wednesday. It follows a weekend attack led by the United States, Britain, and France that took aim at Syria's chemical weapons facilities. Joining us now to discuss the latest developments is Professor Amin Saikal, Director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. What is your reaction to the actions taken?
As President Trump and also Prime Minister May, as well as President Macron, said this was well-targeted and basically targeted three important areas to degrade the chemical and biological capability of the Assad regime. But I think at the same time, they definitely wanted to send also a strong message to Moscow and Tehran as the strong supporters of the Assad regime, despite the fact that both Tehran and Moscow had warned the United States and its allies against these sort of actions.
President Vladimir Putin is warning that further Western attacks on Syria will bring chaos to world affairs.
Ultimately, I don't think any of these major parties would like to enter into a confrontation in Syria. I think the United States and its allies would like to really avoid a confrontation, and that's why the targets that they had were very much well-selected, which did not really result in any major damage to either the Iranians or, for that matter, to the Russians. And also, I don't think that Russia and Iran would like to really engage in a confrontation with the United States in Syria. I mean, unless the whole situation spirals out of control, which is always a possibility, but I think it's not in the interest of any of these parties to engage in a major confrontation in Syria that could easily develop into a much bigger and a bigger international crisis.
It certainly does seem like a complicated issue when you consider that now even the Arab League leaders are calling for an international probe into the use of chemical weapons in Syria, condemning what they see as Iran's interference in the affairs of other countries. So, you know, Syria's really getting it from quite a few sides now, although it does have allies in Iran. Iran and Russia?
There is no question that the situation is very complicated and also at the same time potentially very, very dangerous for international security. And it is understandable on the part of the Arab countries and, of course, Israel to call for more actions. And, of course, also it may be understandable on the part of the United States to impose more sanctions on Russia. But I think, to me, it appears that the United States and some of its allies have may have decided on a wider strategy, and that is to really squeeze in the Putin government to the extent which is possible, and also to heighten the pressure on Iran. I think Iran has been lambasted by President Trump for a very long time, and he has threatened to withdraw the United States from the nuclear agreement and so on. And also, Ambassador Nikki Haley made it very clear at the UN that the United States will retain its 2,000 troops in Syria, not only to make sure that Daesh does not make a comeback, but also to monitor the Iranian activities. And I think, to me, that is, to some extent, a recipe for continuation of the conflict in Syria. But that is the decision that the United States has made, and Iranians would be very careful not to really flex muscle with the United States. But if it comes to a confrontation between the two sides, I don't think that the Iranians will necessarily hold back. And then, of course, Israelis could also come into action. So the situation is very, very complicated. And but let's hope that the current tension will be really diffused, and somewhat all sides will exercise a level of moderation in their approach to this problem.
If they do it again, if we see that another chemical weapon attack has taken place, how many times can the U.S. send a warning that gets ignored before it can't really fix the problem?
I think that is really a very difficult question. And the United States has said that if the Assad regime uses chemical weapons, then the United States will definitely act. And Russia, at the same time, has warned that that will result in international chaos. That means that the Russians may well retaliate. But what form the Russian retaliation may take, that's not very clear. I mean, at the Russia has got different options. It's got military options and non-military options. Of course, it's got the option of cyber warfare. It's got the option of squeezing the tide on eastern Ukraine, overshadowing the Baltic states, and possibly expanding its control in Georgia. So they have got this sort of a different option. Which one they are going to really exercise in the event of Assad's regime using chemical weapons against and the United States responding to that?
All right, that's Professor Amin Saikal, Director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Former U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation Director James Comey said President Donald Trump is morally unfit to be president, and he believes there's some evidence Trump obstructed justice. Comey's comments came in an interview with ABC News Sunday before the publication this week of his book, A Higher Loyalty. In part, it recounts his role in investigating Russia's interference in the 2016 election and Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server that contained classified information. He also said the Russians could have compromising information on the president.
I think it's possible. I don't know. These are more words I never thought I'd utter about a president of the United States, but it's possible.
Trump fired Comey last May, agreeing with the Justice Department that he could no longer effectively lead the bureau. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had this to say about the ABC interview.
Comey is a self-admitted leaker. He's been proven to be dishonest, and I think that his credibility is really at hand, and it's quite interesting that he would question someone else's when he has such a lack of credibility himself.
Joining us now to discuss is Robert Deitz, a former special counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, and currently professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. So do you think it was appropriate for a former FBI director to so openly say these things about a president to the media?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I've given a fair amount of thought to it. I'm bothered a little bit by it, only because it's not traditional for people who leave government, even ones who are dismissed. I mean, General Hayden, for example, was dismissed by President Obama when President Obama was elected. And certainly General Hayden did not come out, you know, in his memoirs blasting President Obama. This is unusual, but in many respects, I'm sympathetic because Mr. Trump invites it. Remember, he's been tweeting about Comey since the time he fired him. And I think it must have been very, very difficult to simply ignore all that. And, you know, Comey's comment that the president is morally unfit to be president. I mean, again, that's not something you would expect from somebody writing his memoirs, having served in government. But Mr. Trump tends to invite that kind of thing by his intemperate blasts on Twitter.
Do you think that some of the things that Comey is coming out saying could jeopardize the Mueller investigation?
I don't think so. Mr. Comey has no position in government now. Certainly if a senior to Mueller, and obviously there are not many, Rod Rosenstein and Attorney General Sessions, if they came out with certain types of comments, that could jeopardize an investigation. But an ex-employee, I don't see how it could, other than if he came out with certain types of classified information, although I'm not even sure there exactly how it would have an effect. Certainly, if Mr. Trump is indicted or ends up in court in some context, people no doubt will cite this book.
We're under the impression that the president cannot fire the special counsel Robert Mueller, but there is talk that he...
Nonsense. Of course he can fire him. He would have to do it indirectly, but that's not that difficult. Taking you back to the Nixon days, if you recall, he ordered Attorney General Richardson to fire the special prosecutor, Archie Cox. Richardson would not do it and resigned. President Nixon then ordered the Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus, to fire Archie Cox, and he refused, and he retired or resigned. You can always find some fact is you can always find somebody to do the deed.
What if he fires Rod Rosenstein, who is overseeing Mueller?
I think that is would be a huge problem. Let me tell you why. Both Rosenstein and Mueller are two of the most upright people you will find in government. And both, by the way, I think are registered Republicans. Mm-hmm. I've known Rod, worked with him some, and I've worked with Mueller and know him a bit. And Mueller in particular always reminds me of a sort of a 17th century New England preacher like Cotton Mather. I don't think I've ever seen him laugh. I've heard him laugh. He is absolutely ramrod straight and ethical, and the same is true with Rod. And so I think there would be an absolute firestorm if he tried to get rid of Rosenstein. And then derivatively, Mueller.
Is there another replacement tactic that the president could potentially do to name a replacement in order to fire Mueller?
I don't think so. I mean, I think anything that results in the firing of Mueller would create a firestorm, I think, even among Republicans, because it would just be too reminiscent of the so-called Saturday Night Massacre under Nixon. And by the way, Archie Cox, in many ways, is very much like Mueller. That is upright, honest, ethical, and so forth. And Mueller has those same kinds of credentials. You know, head of the FBI, had been a hero during the Vietnam War, and so forth. It's just, it's hard to see how that ends in a way that would do Mr. Trump any good.
All right. Robert Deitz, professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters, the 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Consumers in the Chinese capital of Beijing are watching closely the simmering trade spat between China and the United States, and some are concerned about the possible impact heightened trade frictions, if not an all-out trade war, could have on the cost of goods and the broader economy. VOA's Bill Ide reports.
As the United States and China haggle over market access, intellectual property rights, and other complex trade issues, the simple question consumers in Beijing are wondering is what impact will the dispute have on the cost of goods, and will they ultimately be left carrying the weight as prices rise? China has already placed tariffs on U.S. fruit, nuts, and pork, among other products. Few at this local market were feeling the impact yet, but with the likelihood of higher prices for imports such as nuts and fruit on the horizon, this vendor says he's already weighing his options.
I can just stop buying U.S. goods and stop selling products from America. I can just buy goods from China.
Chinese authorities have repeatedly voiced confidence they are prepared to fight to the end if Washington goes ahead with tariffs on 1,300 imports from China. But neither side knows for certain just how broad an impact the tariffs could have. Wang Chongyun says she spends her summers in San Diego and is a fan of Michael Kors products. She hopes the two sides will sit down and talk. If not, consumers will end up footing the bill.
It will have an impact on the Chinese economy, and that has an impact on the public's interests. With higher tariffs and prices, we'll have to spend more.
If the U.S. does go ahead with its tariffs, most consumers say they will just buy other foreign products or domestic brands.
China
no longer lags behind, and it can make whatever its people need. There's no need to rely on the U.S. Take sports apparel, for example. There are plenty of domestic brands to choose from.
If they want to make money here, they have to work together with China, because there are a lot of Chinese.
However, access to the Chinese market is what the dispute is all about. A few that VOA spoke with were aware of what Washington is demanding, or even the huge gap in access that exists between Chinese companies operating in the United States and the gridlock American and other foreign firms face here. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Well, two recent Western films on Russia, one a Hollywood spy thriller, the other an independent historical satire, depict the country's dark political underbelly. How much of that portrayal is an exaggeration for entertainment's sake, and how much is a take from reality? Experts and filmmakers say it's a little bit of both. VOA's Penelope Pulu set out to find out.
From this day forward, you will become sparrows. Weapons in a global struggle for power.
The recent spy film Red Sparrow follows Dominika Egorova, played by Jennifer Lawrence, into a present-day Russian intelligence facility where trainees are schooled in information extraction through the art of seduction. In an interview with the Voice of America, Lawrence defended the sexually charged spy film as realistic and liberating.
I think people feel so empowered. I think that to watch a woman take control of her body and her sexuality and use it and use her mind to win, and she's always four steps ahead of everybody else.
At the International Spy Museum in Washington, curator Vince Houghton is surrounded by Cold War-era spycraft. Umbrellas that can fire tiny pellets filled with poison, fake Russian and U.S. passports, and bugging devices. Houghton says many of these items inspired classic Hollywood spy films and may be still used in some capacity into today's spycraft. But others, he says, like sparrow schools in Russia, are a thing of the past.
Certainly during the Cold War, there were schools that trained women within the Soviet Union to use their bodies, to use sexuality, to gain intelligence. It wasn't just women. The East Germans, so Russian proxies, were very effective at using what we call Romeo spies.
Are we going to become friends?
Today, he says, such practices are frowned upon.
The CIA, you can actually get fired if it's found out that you had a relationship with one of your assets, one of your sources.
So, Howden says, though Red Sparrow may be an entertaining film, its flawed timeline and two-dimensional characters undermine what could be accurate depictions of Russian espionage and political ruthlessness today.
Take off your dress.
This is a American view or a Western view of the Russians. And that goes back throughout the Cold War and a lot of the pop culture that you see, whether it's Hunt for October or moving to some of the John le Carré films. The idea of the Russian or the Soviet as being kind of a unfeeling, it's designed to create a bad guy. It's designed to create a dehumanized bad guy.
Stalin's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Comedy about Russian politics can also be controversial. The Death of Stalin, an Anglo-French satire on the race to succeed Stalin, brings to light stranger-than-fiction anecdotal stories, such as how Stalin loved to entertain his cabinet ministers till late at night with John Wayne and John Ford westerns, or how many Russians went to bed wearing several layers of clothing so in case they were dragged out of their beds and off to Siberia, they could keep warm.
It's our, comic response to those events. So I'm not saying at the top of the film this is true. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is watch it for what it is, and then when you go afterwards, if you're intrigued, go online and have a look, and you'll be amazed by how much of it happens to be true.
Yanucci says though his film was banned from Russian theaters before the recent presidential elections there, it has been embraced by Russian audiences who watched it online. He says The Death of Stalin is satirizing the Kremlin and the absurdity of the purges, not the plight of the Russian people. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Sunday, April 1st, the Costa Rican people went to the polls to elect a new president. According to Freedom House, Costa Rica has a long history of democratic stability, with a multi-party political system and regular transitions of power through free and fair elections. This tradition continued this year, with two rounds of free and fair elections. This was a runoff election, a second go-around. In the first round, which took place on February 4th of this year, neither Fabricio Alvarado Munoz from the National Restoration Party nor Carlos Alvarado Quesada from the ruling Citizens Action Party received more than 40% of the vote, requiring a runoff between the top two candidates. Heading into the second round, all indications were that this would be a very close election. In the end, Carlos Alvarado Quesada defeated Fabricio Alvarez Munoz 61% to 39%. Even though voters held strong opinions about their chosen candidates, campaign rhetoric was respectful and there were no reports of election-related violence. There was a peaceful transition of power, a hallmark of strong democratic institutions. The losing candidate conceded the election with grace and in a conciliatory manner, and the winning candidate accepted the victory with humility and praise for his opponent. The United States congratulates Carlos Alvarado Quesada on his election as the new president of Costa Rica in free, fair, and peaceful voting that continues to be a model for the region, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Our long and enduring partnership with Costa Rica is rooted in a shared history of support for human rights, democracy, and security for all people. Costa Rica plays a key role as our partner, promoting regional economic prosperity, security, and good governance throughout the hemisphere, she said. We look forward to building on that partnership with the Alvarado administration.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.